Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. My name is Anne Holsinger, and I am the Information and Resource Specialist at the Death Penalty Information Center. Our guest today is Steve Bright, the former president of the Southern Center for Human Rights, who now teaches law at Yale, Georgetown, and Georgia State University. Mr. Bright has argued four cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and is joining us today to discuss one of those cases, Foster v. Chapman, and the ongoing problem of racial discrimination in jury selection. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just jump right in. I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with your impressive work in the field of indigent criminal defense, but for those who might be new to the issue, could you tell us briefly about your career and the work of the Southern Center for Human Rights?
Sure. I was at the Southern Center for Human Rights for about 35 years, and during that time, we represented a number of people in the South, in Mississippi, and Georgia, and Florida, and Alabama, and elsewhere, facing the death penalty at trials, on appeals, and in the post-conviction review process of cases. We also did a lot of work about unconstitutional practices and conditions in prisons and jails, and increasingly, racial discrimination in the criminal justice system and the right of people accused of crimes to competent lawyers for their legal representation in any kind of case, whether it's a capital case when obviously the right to a lawyer is critically important, or any other kind of case in which a person's liberty is at stake.
One of the many issues you litigated is discrimination against racial minorities in jury selection. How widespread of a problem is that, and what laws are in place to prevent the exclusion of people of color from juries?
Well, a number of courts, like the Washington Supreme Court, have said that racial discrimination in jury selection is rampant in our court system. The Supreme Court of the United States decided a case called Batson versus Kentucky, which was supposed to prevent that discrimination from continuing. I don't think anybody doubts that it had been going on for a very long period of time. But now, 30 years after that case was decided, it's pretty clear that it has failed completely to prevent race discrimination in jury selection. I should say that there's race discrimination in a lot of places where discretionary decisions are made in processing people through the criminal courts in terms of what people are charged with, in terms of whether the prosecution seeks the death penalty or not, in terms of whether the death penalty is dropped in exchange for a plea bargain. But the most pervasive race discrimination that's going on is in jury selection, because very often prosecutors will strike all the people of color who are qualified to serve on a jury, meaning that a person is often tried by an all-white jury, even in communities that have a very substantial African-American or Hispanic population.
How is it that that problem has persisted so much despite the Batson decision?
Because the Batson decision doesn't really have any teeth. It says that if the prosecution strikes a number of people of color, and say all, that it creates an inference that there's discrimination, but then it's easily resolved by the prosecutor giving reasons for the strikes. And as long as there are non-racial reasons, the courts uphold that. There are a couple of problems with that. The first is that prosecutors distribute at their continuing legal education programs reasons to give. So, of course, the reasons are supposed to be the actual reasons, but we know that very often prosecutors just simply look down at a list of reasons and read a couple of them off. So that makes it fairly easy to dodge this requirement. But the second thing is it requires a finding by the judge that the prosecutor intentionally discriminated on the basis of race and then lied about it by giving a pretextual reason instead of the actual reason. Most judges are very reluctant to make those findings. They know the prosecutors. Often they were in the same office with the prosecutor. Many judges were prosecutors before they became judge. And just psychologically, it's hard to say that somebody is a racist and a liar. But that's what you have to show in order to win a Batson strike. If the judge finds those things are true, that there was intentional race discrimination and that there was a pretext pretextual reason given, then the judge can allow the juror to be seated and not allow that strike to be exercised. But one academic review of this said there's more likelihood of being struck by lightning than a judge finding that there's race discrimination in selecting a juror.
Wow. So in 2015, you argued Foster v. Chapman in the U.S. Supreme Court, and that was a case that featured some particularly egregious evidence of racial bias in jury selection. What did prosecutors do in that case that made it stand out?
Well, that case is one of the very few cases where we have been able to pull back the cloak of secrecy and find out what the reasons actually were. At the time of the trial, the prosecutors gave 8 to 12 reasons for striking all four of the African Americans in the jury pool in Tim Foster's case, and getting an all-white jury and then arguing to the all-white jury to impose the death penalty to send a message to the people that lived in the projects. 90% of the people that lived in the projects were African-American. Many, many years after the trial, we were able, through the Georgia Open Records Act, to get the prosecutor's file. And they apparently forgot to shred the notes from jury selection because they revealed obsession with race, that all the black people were highlighted in green, and the letter B was written by their names, and it was circulated in the office to find reasons for striking those people, that the prosecution had listed the African-American jurors as B1, B2, B3, and so forth, that they had a list of definite no's of people who were to be struck, and the first five people on it were African-Americans, and then only one other person, a white woman, who had said that she could not vote to impose the death penalty. So those were the people the prosecution was absolutely determined to exclude. And then there were things like a memorandum from an investigator that compared the black people to each other and said, if we have to accept the black people, maybe Ms. Garrett would be okay. But Ms. Garrett was never going to be on the jury because she was on that list of definite no's. And then a lot of the reasons that the prosecutors gave were actually pretty preposterous on their face. One reason for striking Ms. Garrett was because she was close in age to Mr. Foster. But Ms. Garrett was 36 years old and Mr. Foster was 18. There were white jurors accepted who were 36 or younger, including one 21-year-old person who sat on the jury. So when all this was held up to the light of day and examined, the Supreme Court almost unanimously, with only Justice Thomas dissenting, the Supreme Court held that that there was racial discrimination.
And as a result of that case, Timothy Foster is granted a new trial. Has the ruling in that case affected other cases or had further implications for how juries are selected?
Well, I think that case was unfortunately so unique on its facts because of the smoking guns that we had of the prosecutor's intent, that a lot of other cases, people will say, well, you don't have that kind of information. This case is somewhat like a case out of Philadelphia, in which right after the Batson case had been decided, the prosecutor was giving instructions to other prosecutors about how to strike jurors and was basically telling them how to violate Batson, to strike on the basis of race and to question the black jurors to get reasons and be able to give reasons for striking them. The only reason we know about that is because a videotape of that training session was made public many, many years after it happened. Just as in our case, in the Open Records Act, we were able to get the notes of the prosecutor and see what they really had on their mind, which was race, at the time they exercised their strikes.
Earlier this month, in March 2018, the Southern Center for Human Rights obtained prosecutors' jury selection notes from the 1977 trial of Johnny Gates in Columbus, Georgia. And those notes, like those in Foster's case, showed evidence of intentional racial discrimination. What action is the Southern Center taking in Mr. Gates' case?
Well, that was filed as part of a challenge to the strikes of African Americans in Mr. Gates' case, and it showed that in 7 cases, the prosecutors, and one, I might say, was the same prosecutor who was in the Timothy Foster case, who was found by the Supreme Court of the United States to both be intentionally discriminating and to have lied about it. And that is pretty clear from the records. This, again, was some jury selection records that were made available many years after the trial. They weren't available at trial, but they showed that the prosecutors had singled out the African Americans, that they had referred to them with very derogatory names. And of course, the ultimate decision in the case is striking the people. They struck all of these African Americans in these 7 cases, with the likelihood of that happening by chance being virtually no chance at all.
So cases like Mr. Foster's and Mr. Gates, where there are these smoking guns, as you described it, that clearly demonstrate intentional discrimination, are pretty rare. What do you think can be done to prevent or remedy the kind of discrimination in cases where there isn't such clear-cut evidence?
Well, the easiest thing to do would be to keep track of all the strikes of jurors by prosecutors, and for that matter, by all lawyers. There are not that many cases that go to trial, and it would not be that burdensome to keep track in case after case of how the discretionary, that's the peremptory strikes, are used, the strikes that a lawyer can strike jurors for no reason, any reason, but theoretically they're not supposed to base it on race and gender. There was a study done of the use of those strikes by prosecutors in North Carolina over a very substantial period of time. So you didn't just have one case, you had a whole large number of cases and hundreds of strikes. And when they were analyzed, they showed that a black person is twice as likely to be struck than a white person. So it's pretty powerful evidence when you looked at it like that of race discrimination. That's the least of what could be done. The other thing would be to look at the evidence in a more objective way. What would a reasonable person, knowing all the facts, think? So we don't get into motive and we don't get into lying and not lying, but would a reasonable person who knows all the facts think that there was discrimination here? The answer is going to be yes. I mean, there was a case out of the United States Court of Appeals in Atlanta where the prosecutor struck 22 African Americans in a jury selection in Alabama, and they were upheld that there was no race discrimination because the prosecutor could give a reason for all 22 people. Really, you have to be just dreaming to think that that's totally coincidental that all 22 of those people were African Americans. So those are the kind of remedies that I think courts could employ to look at this more objectively and not get into this test that Batson has where we get into motives and so forth. But otherwise, this is not going to work. I mean, we see that, sure, there are going to be some times in Philadelphia where suddenly this videotape is released to the public, but it was never supposed to be released. And by the same token, the information that came to light in Foster was never supposed to be released to the public. And in other cases where we have sought this information, all the information about jury selection is somehow not there in the files because the prosecutors have removed it.
So if we were to implement the kinds of remedies you suggest and we had a system with more racially inclusive juries, how do you think that would affect the criminal justice system and, in particular, the death penalty system?
Well, I think it would affect them in two ways. I think, first of all, we know that any groups, a lot of studies of groups, make better decisions the more diversity there is of those groups, because there are more things taken into account, more life experiences, more knowledge of all of those people. So we would have better decision-making, more reliable decision-making. We wouldn't have juries discounting things that really shouldn't be discounted. The other thing that we would have is much more faith in the courts and the integrity of the courts by people in society. I think when people go to the courthouse in a community that's one-third African-American, and they look up there and there's no person of color on the jury, it's an all-white jury. The judge is white, the prosecutors are white, the court-appointed lawyers are white. The only person of color in the front of the courtroom is the person on trial. And people do not think that those cases, that those trials are legitimate, because a big portion of the community has been completely excluded from participating in the judicial process.
Mm-hmm. And is that a phenomenon that you still see commonly today?
Oh, you see it all the time. I mean, I think that I go around the South and see this. I don't see it in places like you've got people of color on the county commission or in the legislature or in the city council. But you go to the courthouse and it looks like we're still back in 1940. The criminal courts are the part of our society that have been least affected by the civil rights movement. And we still see race discrimination going on there that we would not see in other areas of American life.
Do you think that inclusion not only of racial minorities and juries, but in those decision-making roles like lawyers, judges, would change the way that the death penalty is practiced in the United States?
I think there's no question about it. 95% of elected prosecutors in all the states that have the death penalty, prosecutors are elected. 95% of all elected prosecutors are white. And I think there's often not the sensitivity. We know that in seeking the death penalty, prosecutors value white lives much more than they value black lives or brown lives. And part of that is because the people making all the decisions in these cases, and these are unchecked decisions, the decision whether or not to seek the death penalty, the decision whether or not to make a plea offer and resolve the case without having a death penalty trial, those are almost all made by often one white person, often one white man. There is not the representation of the community and different points of view that are brought to bear on that decision.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think this is a matter of grave urgency, the discrimination that's going on in picking juries. Certainly some courts, like the Washington Supreme Court, have seen this as a matter of urgency. They've at least adopted some different approach with regard to striking of jurors. And I think you see other courts that will sort of say this is going on and will sort of wring their hands, but they don't really do anything. They just keep threatening to do something. But this is going on. It's undermining confidence in the courts. It's undermining people's view of the legitimacy of the courts. And it really is something that needs to be addressed.
What has the Washington Supreme Court adopted that's different than other states?
Well, for one thing, they have said that when there are not as many people of color in Washington as there are in the Deep South, where a third of the population in many states is people of color. But they've said when there's one person struck, that there's a per se rule that strike will be examined, that they won't allow the judge to say, no, there's not a prima facie case. There's a rule pending in Washington right now that would adopt the standard I suggested, which would be the reasonable person. Would a reasonable person, knowing all the information, how many strikes were used, how many were against blacks, what were the reasons given, would that person think that there was race discrimination going on? That's a very, very different standard than was there intentional race discrimination, and did the prosecutor lie in giving a reason that was not the true reason? Unfortunately, this Batson decision really encourages people who are representing the state or the United States to make up reasons or to use reasons off a list to justify their strikes. And it's very unfortunate that people would do that, but there's no question absolutely that they do.
Do you think it could be necessary to get rid of peremptory strikes altogether to prevent this problem?
Well, a lot of people have proposed that, but that doesn't seem to go anywhere. Justice Breyer, from time to time, has proposed it. Thurgood Marshall proposed it when the Batson case was decided. Justice Goldberg proposed it many years before that. But there does not seem to be any movement in the state legislatures or elsewhere for that to happen. I do think that there might be someday that courts will or legislatures will reduce the number of peremptory strikes. No side should have 22 peremptory strikes. We often see Alabama cases where the prosecution has exercised 15, 20 strikes in a case because of the way they pick the juries there. There's one state, Virginia, where there are only 3 strikes. That makes it much harder to skew the jury racially the way that it's done. I mean, the most common number is somewhere around 10. And very often, if you only have, like in the Foster case, you have, there were 5 black people in the pool. One was excused for cause and 4 were struck by the prosecutor. If you have more peremptory strikes than there are people of color in the jury veneer, then it's going to be possible for the prosecution to strike all those people.
Well, thank you again. We really appreciate you joining us and sharing your expertise on this important issue.
Well, thank you again for having me.
To learn more about the work of the Southern Center for Human Rights, visit schr.org. To learn more about the death penalty, visit deathpenaltyinfo.org. Subscribe to Discussions with DPIC in your podcast app to make sure you never miss an episode.